Hello everyone and welcome to an Airline Pilot Podcast from Flight Level 320. This is a podcast all about aviation and flight simulation hosted by myself, 320 Sim Pilot, a real-world airline pilot, flight simmer and YouTuber. I'll be joined by other pilots and experienced flight simmers as we discuss all things aviation and flight sim, answer questions from the community and chat about what it's like to take some of these incredible machines into the sky. This is from Flight Level 320. In today's episode, we take a slightly different format as we interview our special guest, the one and only Katie Pilot. Katie is a real-world Airbus pilot who many of you may already know from Twitch streams and also Katie's excellent work on other flight sim projects such as the Phoenix Simulations A320. In this podcast, I'll be talking with Katie about starting a career in aviation, what led to streaming on Twitch, as well as finding out Katie's favourite destinations, aircraft and top tips for new pilots and simmers and much, much more. As always, thank you all so much for your continued feedback on the podcast. I really, really do appreciate it. If you do have any questions for future podcasts, you can send them to simpilot320@hotmail.com or join the 320 SimPilot Discord. All views expressed in today's podcast are myself and Katie's only. They do not represent those of our employers. Please keep up on spreading the word about the podcast. It makes all the difference and it's what's enabled me to bring you different content such as this interview today. That's it then. Let's get started with the interview and I hope you enjoy it. So welcome to the podcast to Katie Pilot. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
No, it's our absolute pleasure. So yeah, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit to start off with. The sort of first question I did with Barney when he came on was sort of what got you into aviation? What led you to this point and why did you choose to go into aviation at all?
Yeah, so I didn't really know. I've kind of had a big think to myself, like, what exactly got me into aviation? And the only thing I can really think of is that I went on holiday when I was 10. It was just after 9/11. I knew my mum was very nervous to travel and I was really excited. Because obviously, you know, being 9, you don't really understand things like that. All I could see was, wow, this big aeroplane, I get to go on it. And
yeah.
and it was a Britannia 757 from Cardiff to Arrecife.
Fantastic.
And then I got stung by jellyfish on that holiday quite early on. So I ended up kind of just, well, the highlight of my holiday was the journey there and the journey back. And so I was so just mesmerized by this big aircraft. I was like, I got to do that. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
It just never changed. My kind of like goal just never changed. And even to this day, I'm just like, you know, I'm still very motivated on what I do. So I'm glad, you know, that jellyfish was a good jellyfish, helped me out.
yeah, what a moment to find a holiday. Yeah, it's I think as well the 757, because that's the same airplane that got me into really loving the idea of flying. It's a big machine, isn't it? It's very impressive when you walk up to it, especially when you're down in the, you know, these holiday places and you have to walk up steps to get on the planes and you get to see them in the flesh. It's hard not
absolutely.
To be enamored with them, isn't it?
They're yeah, and especially something. When you're 9 or 10.
Yeah.
You know, you're half the size of what you are now.
Yeah.
So it looks twice the size to you. So it's like I just remember I can't believe this thing's gonna go up in the sky.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be on it. And I always think back to that kind of feeling. And that has just stuck with me. And every time I go flying, I'm still very like, I'm like, wow, this is so cool.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't get old, that idea of what you're doing. Sometimes you're more tired about it or things are going not wrong, but you know, more stressful days than others where exactly. You've got lots going on. But even so, when you sit and think, oh, I'm, you know, 6 miles up here and we're whizzing along and it's normal.
Definitely.
It's just normal. Like that's how it's done all the time. Those planes spend most of their time doing that. And the 757, so you said Britannia 757. Do you remember the livery by any chance?
All I remember, and I guess it was their standard livery with
blue?
Like the... Yeah, I seem to remember like a woman with like a crown maybe and like a star.
Oh, right. Oh, no, that's maybe. So that's the proper Britannia livery. Yeah, so I would call it the proper one. My channel is heavily heavily themed on these 90s liveries. And that is the Britannia livery with lots and lots of stripes down the side. And then they had
That sounds about right.
I absolutely love that livery. We fly it on the channel whenever I get the chance. And then they went to a sort of a hybrid with TUI when they became TUI, the blue one, which came later, which I wouldn't count as a proper Britannia livery, although of course it is. But
I think for me, just like I associate Britannia with that logo.
Yeah, me too.
And because that, but then even then, like I grew up in Somerset, so my local airport was actually Bristol.
Oh, right.
So I didn't really, I'm just trying to think of like aircraft that I used to see them in a bit of EasyJet around. But I don't remember seeing much of Britannia aside from the time that we went on holiday.
No, they're quite, they've always been quite good at sort of, they and TUI do it now, don't they, where they have flights out of small airports around the country at just for like the season. And so they don't have like a continuous presence all the time. They're always available at your local airport. Well, they try to be available at your local airport, I guess. It's quite a good idea, really. But yeah. So that's it. 757 was one of my inspirations as well. So it's funny that you've had this a similar sort of path. I think it's common as well for pilots. I don't know how you found it with the other pilots you fly with at work. Nearly always have a fairly similar story.
You fly with quite a few who come from aviation backgrounds, like maybe their parents were pilots, or you know, they were, you know, they've been in the Air Force just doing something else or whatever, but they've so quite a few people have these like backgrounds in aviation, but the ones who don't tend to have that, similar to what I said and what you've said, of just kind of having the background of like, God, I went on holiday, or I saw
just a
plane,
moment
and
on
I liked
holiday.
It.
Yeah, that's really true, actually, because I've not got any background family wise or anything like that. So it was the same for me, actually. Yeah, just going on a holiday, and to my parents, it's just the way to get there. But to me, it became the ultimate moment, and then it was all I could think about, talk about, was the flight before and on the way home. Just waiting to come home, sitting on the beach, looking at the airplanes leaving the island, going, yep, can't wait. Parents obviously sitting there thinking, oh, I really do not want to fly back tomorrow, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I remember once I went on holiday, it was a bit later on in life, with a few friends, and one of my friends was quite an avid technological person, and he was into computer science and that sort of stuff, and he set me up a scanner thing so I could listen to air traffic when you sit on the beach and watch them fly over.
Yeah,
and like I was like, wow, this is so cool.
Yeah.
You know, and that, again, it's kind of one of those things where I was like, that, what, this is definitely 100% the thing I want to do.
Yeah,
but I did find it funny that when we were all sat at flight school, kind of made this point, which was, well, I really hope we do like this, because there's no try before you buy. There's you know, you can't do work experience as a pilot because, you know, you're not allowed in the flight deck. So it was very much, you just have to know innately that that's what you want to do. I thought, God, I hope I like it. You know,
it's a really good point, that it's one of the, I mean, I never had any doubt, but at the same time, I had no reason not to have any doubt, because like you say, actually, I don't know, not done it yet.
Exactly.
I know that something that I was recommended early on was get yourself into a small aircraft and just go for some flights and see if you enjoy that. Because if you don't, it doesn't matter whether you would enjoy being a pilot at an airline, because you need to enjoy flying small aircraft as well to get there.
That's very, very true.
And that sort of, it and I think it helps, because if you want to become a pilot, I always say this to people who ask, I get obviously asked a lot, and I'm sure you have as well, about becoming a pilot, and do you need to be smart or good at maths or physics or whatever, but none of it's massively complicated. There are a base level of qualifications you need, but it's just a lot of stuff, and it's not interesting to people who don't really, really love flying, because there's so much of it to take in. But
your ATPL ground school, depending on where you're doing it around the world, but certainly in the UK, it's 14 exams.
Yeah, that's a lot.
you do for us, we did it in the space of 6 months. And so we did seven in phase one and then seven in phase two. And like you say, the volume of information that there is there to take in.
Yeah, it's fast, isn't it? And
It is.
it's
And as I say, if you're not interested in it, then that
yeah.
is going to be one hell of a long 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think these are those barriers. And then if you still like it after all that, the chances are you must have already been madly obsessed and really want to do the job anyway.
Totally, because ground school will beat
Yeah, exactly.
it
Yeah. Well, that brings me on to what led you so what was the path you took then to becoming, so you're currently a pilot on the A320 family.
That's correct, yeah.
So yeah, what was your path to that point?
Yeah, so kind of after holiday when I was 9 or 10, joined the air cadets when I was 13. Did a bit of air experience flying with them. So that was kind of the, again, that in fact, that was the first time I've been flying in light aircraft. And I just
Right.
remember just being hooked from the second the wheels left the ground. In fact, even probably before then, the second they started the engine, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Big grin on my face, you know.
Fair
Didn't get on with aerobatics though,
enough.
as I discovered fairly early on.
Yeah.
Filled up a couple of the old sick bags, but you know, still enjoyed it, but just my body said no.
Were you a passenger for those?
So for the aerobatics, no. So
You
well,
were
yes, you
flying
are
them.
technically you're a passenger, like as
Yeah.
far as the, you know, legalities go. But you're flying with a very, very experienced Air Force pilot who will show you. You'll
Yeah.
follow the through and through on the controls, and then they'll go, okay, you have a go.
Yeah.
And of course, it's your control. So if you did anything wrong, they'd, you know.
Yeah, so that they are effectively, they're still effectively in control of the aircraft.
Correct.
But yeah,
But
it's
as a, you know, as a 13-year-old putting an aircraft into a loop, that's like, whoa.
yeah. Your body's not used to that sort of thing, and then and it's in particular if the other person flies it first and then you do it, that's a lot of loops and things. And I find being a passenger for anything like that, I really struggle. I can't be a passenger in a light aircraft, or certainly not in the back. I get airsick quite easily like that. It's quite strange.
Yeah, it's funny you
No
should
problem on
say that.
airliners, but
Yeah, really funny you should say that because when I was doing some gliding, we were thermaling, which obviously involves just going round and round and round.
so thermaling is when you're, because I've never done gliding because I wasn't in the air cadets, and I always for reasons you're discussing here, I always recommend people to go and take a look and see if the air cadets are for them. So the air cadets, for those of you who aren't familiar, or it's a in the UK, it's a free sort of, I don't know how you'd best describe it, a club that you can join, or a,
Yeah,
it's
it is a, I guess it's an extracurricular club, isn't it? You know, for
yeah.
was it 13 to 20-year-olds or
Yeah, so when
maybe?
you're a young adult or a teenager, and you can join the Air Cadets, which is a associated heavily with the Royal Air Force in the UK, and it's free, and it offers a lot of young people their first taste of aviation, and also is it slightly a military style life, I suppose you could say. I don't know. I wasn't in
Yeah, I think
it.
it's like a it's kind of giving you that insight into forces life and forces discipline
Yeah.
and but also opens so many different doors in terms of like the flying and do shooting and adventurous training and there's I can't recommend it enough. It really gave me a good start in life, really.
Yeah, I if I went back and, you know, did my teenage years again, I would have joined the Air Cadets definitely, because everyone I meet who did it loved it, and they've had so many different experiences. And like yourself then, so we were talking about gliding for a second there, and that got you into gliding, and I've never done it. Something I do want to try one day. So you mentioned thermaling in gliding, which is when your hot air is rising off the ground, and gliders obviously have no engine, but they can sit in that rising air and actually climb with it. They don't, they that's how they can stay up in the air. You can stay up all day really, can't you, if you find enough thermal.
Yeah, so they can do cross country competitions. They can essentially just stay up all day. They just go up in these thermals, and what you do is there's an audible sound that tells you whether you're in rising air or descending air. So if you hear the sound says you're in rising air, you go, oh, brilliant, let's stay there. And so you just do circles. So you
Yeah.
just like put a bit of bag cord and go round. And quite often you'll look for birds that might be doing it in that area. So it's the one time in aviation you want to be around the birds.
Yeah. Right. Yes, of course.
But yeah, you'll see buzzards doing this, these, you know, in thermals, you know, are brilliant. There must be one over there.
That's great,
So
isn't
you go
it?
and join them and you'll go round and round and round. And I was doing this with an instructor. And we'd probably been in this thermal maybe for about 10 minutes or so. And I said to him, I was like, I'm feeling really queasy now because we've just been going around in circles. And he just goes, all right, you have control. And probably within 30 seconds, I was good again because I was flying. And so it's really interesting when you just said as a passenger, you struggle in a light aircraft.
Yeah. It's a real thing where it's that thing of, you know, passengers and cars, obviously it's the same thing, isn't it? Where your body can't tense up, and it applies exactly the same in flying. Mm-hmm. I don't thankfully have any problems in airliners as a passenger or as pilot monitoring, as it were, where you're effectively a passenger,
mm-hmm.
but we don't tend to do maneuvering at the same level. You know, flying around in general aviation or gliding, you can pull 1.5 to 2 G's mm-hmm. quite regularly.
Whereas in an airliner, you're literally like, everything is designed to remain at 1 G.
Yeah, exactly.
Even when, you know, when you're in a turn, the idea is the passengers can't even tell you're in a turn unless they can see.
Exactly. And there's people standing up, you know, in the cabin, so that we can't be doing anything crazy.
Serving tea and coffee and we're there, you know, banking at 30 degrees.
It is amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so that's really interesting that you had that. And yeah, I never thought about the swapping control. But I get it as in aerobatics, I had it as well when I was a passenger, but when flying it, not so much. Although I'm sure the people sitting in the plane with me would have maybe disagree with my dodgy aerobatics, but there we go.
I'm sure they were fine.
Cool. So yeah, so you did your gliding.
My air cadets,
Air cadets.
And then that kind of naturally took me to the University Air Squadron, which is fairly similar to the air cadets in the regard of, you know, it's a military organization.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve Squadron that is attached to universities. So alongside your degree, you go along and you hold a rank and you, again, similar thing, you do adventurous training and the various different things. We also do a flying syllabus.
Right. So you actually got some sort of course that you're really correct. Doing flight training by this point.
Correct. So you basically do what they in the Air Force they call it EFC, so elementary flying training. EFT, sorry, elementary flying training.
Yeah.
And you essentially do a short version of that, which is more or less the equivalent of the UK PPL.
Right.
It doesn't give you a PPL, but
no.
You essentially do enough flying that if you did want to go and convert it to a PPL, you could just go
do
to
the skills
and
test
say,
or something.
Correct. Like maybe you'd learn to fly a Piper or something quickly and then off you go, sort of thing, because you've done everything up to then.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So,
it's
something you can only do in university, though. You have to be, because the air cadets, obviously, you don't have to be in a certain school, but the university air squadron.
So the university air squadron recruit directly from the universities.
Right.
So they'll be at the freshers' fairs. I actually, because I knew I wanted to join them when I chose my universities, I literally went online to the university air squadron website to find out which universities they were attached to and then applied to those. Because I was like, I'm not going to university unless I'm going to join an air squadron.
And it's that thing, isn't it, where you start when you get obsessed young about becoming a pilot, you start to adapt all of your educational life around how can I get there. And you don't need to. If anyone's listening and they haven't done that, it doesn't matter. But it's something that I did as well, where I started to, all my subjects were thinking, well, how can this help me become a pilot? And in the end, I'd say a lot of what I did didn't matter, whereas joining the air cadets or the squadron would have been a good idea. Things I didn't
do. You're right. And actually, one thing that's really interesting is the one thing I do say to people now, actually, when people say, oh, you know, should I be doing maths and physics and stuff? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, you know, if you're good at it and you enjoy it, then yeah, like go for it. But if you're not, if it doesn't overly excite you, you're probably better off going and getting, you know, good grades in something you're interested in than kind of mediocre grades in something you think that airlines want. Because actually, all they're looking for is someone with motivation, someone who meets the requirements, of course, of, you know, you have to have, I think it's like a C in maths to be able to start a,
yeah, so there are some
flight
base requirements,
stuff,
yeah,
of course,
which will vary on countries and airline schemes and so on.
Totally. But once they've kind of ticked the box to say, okay, you have the minimum requirements, that kind of goes in a box and they go, all right, cool, they
yeah.
meet the requirements. But then they're kind of now looking at, okay, this person, are they motivated? What else have they done on top of their studies to really show that that's what they want to do and they have, you know, really want to become a pilot?
Yeah.
So I think there's, yeah, there's definitely more that you can be doing on the side of
Yeah.
school and college and university that will really help in that interview and
Things like,
get you the interview in the first place.
Yeah, getting some flight hours in towards your PPL, or if you can get a sort of work experience at an airfield in any of the departments, all of this sort of stuff just shows that you've got that drive and you really airplanes where you want to be.
There was a guy in my course who he went and volunteered at a microlight centre.
Yeah, great.
You know, literally getting, and it, the only reason he did that as well at the time, I mean, of course he wanted to be a pilot, was basically once a month the chief instructor would sometimes go, did you want to come flying?
Yeah, that's
and,
it.
And like, yeah. And that was his, you know, carrot, if you like.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think there's definitely that sort of, you have to show willing, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so that University Air Squadron, you then went from there to into flight school, I guess?
No, so I applied to the airlines for cadetships.
Yep.
When I finished university, I was unsuccessful in that that one initially, and then
hugely competitive. That any cadet scheme,
I
always recommend people apply for them because you never know, but also don't be too put off if you can't get one, because of course they always oversubscribed by tens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did look at the numbers after, and I think they took, I want to say they took on about 70 out of 7,000 people
yeah.
who applied or something.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
you just go
yeah.
You know, but the one thing, like, you know, I could have been deterred by that because of, you know, oh, well, there's the chance of me getting in a so slim, then I won't, you know, I won't bother. But, and I've said this to my community, that someone's got to get in.
Yeah.
And so therefore, why
definitely
won't
go
that
for it.
Be you?
Yeah. I totally agree with that. You have to go for it, because it sounds ridiculous, like there's no chance, but there's no guarantee. Someone needs to get it, and there'll be plenty who apply who didn't even have the right criteria and were just trying their luck or anything like that, you know. So don't even think about that. Just if you know you
exactly.
want it,
And
just prove it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like I remember kind of like sitting there in the interview, you know, waiting area and stuff, and I'm sure some of these people saw me as their competition, I suppose, in that regard. Like, anyone sat in that room, oh, well, I'm competing against them. But actually I was like, no, I'm competing against myself, like, here, because
yeah.
If I have the required you know, if I look like a future pilot to them, then, you know, I'll get it. And regardless of these people here, like, if they like the look of me, then they'll take me on. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, in the first instance, they didn't like the look of me.
No.
And so I kind of went away, felt quite deflated, thinking, oh my God, I've been working my entire life for this and didn't get it. And I went off and became an accountant for
right.
2 years. So I joined a graduate scheme with Morrison's, the supermarket.
Right. Yeah.
On their
brilliant
finance graduate scheme, and then qualified as a chartered accountant. And then during the time I was doing all those exams, I applied to a cadet scheme again.
Yeah.
Same one, different flight school.
Yeah.
But same one. And that time around, I was successful. And funnily enough, part of what I put down my success in that regard was the life experience I gained
yeah,
from that job, and
absolutely.
not and just having an appreciation for what it's like, you know, working in industry.
Yeah.
And then also I had a stable income and job. So the pressure I put on myself was a lot less. So when I went for interview, I was like, you know what? I'd love to do this. However, if I don't get in, then I'm going to do really well in finance. I'm going to use that money to fund myself.
And then you can go flying. Yeah, you have a way to fly here either way.
Correct.
Exactly.
Correct. So I kind of, as I said, the pressure was off in that regard.
Interesting. Yeah.
Actually, I think sometimes when there's less pressure on a situation, you perform better.
Yep.
And that couldn't have been more true for me, I think, in that scenario.
How interesting. Yeah. And it's funny you say about having that life experience and then being successful, because I've had you know, unsuccessful applications, as we all have in aviation. Mm-hmm. Every time you go through a flying job, it's always a challenge. And I've had similar things where I've not got something and then gone away, done something different, and then lo and behold, next time around managed. Because I do the same thing. I put it down to what I did in between. Mm-hmm. Went and did something totally different with my life, and that really helped. It doesn't have to be different from flying, but just anything to broaden your experience. Mm-hmm. Can make you just appreciate what you're trying to apply for and get your points across better and all of this stuff. It just takes time, doesn't it? It takes practice.
I think
basically.
So and I think that a part of being unsuccessful, going away and still doing something else and then coming back, that in itself shows resilience.
Yeah, they love to see that. Yeah, that's true.
And part of, certainly as a pilot, quite a lot of what we do involves kind of looking, having a situation happen and go, okay, that happened, park it, forget, like move past us, focus on the job at hand, and we'll come back to it later and review. And I think that is, that's very much like, you know, that whole process of applying, being unsuccessful and coming back. I think that shows that in its own, in its own bigger way, I suppose.
No, absolutely. Totally agree. Yeah. It's definitely something airlines can appreciate. Definitely. Well, that, and then, so you were a cadet and then that took you into your flight job.
That's correct. Yeah. With the current airline I'm with. So
right.
I've moved bases, but in terms of, so since qualifying as a pilot, I've flown the 320 as a first officer for 5.5 years now.
Fantastic. Yeah. Excellent. So that answers my next question, which was, what's your first aircraft? Which sounds like being air cadets would be a grob tutor then. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Grob tutor. So that was your first experience.
And that was the air experience flying that I did.
Yeah.
But the first one I soloed in was the glider. So we did the AEF lines, air experience flying was in the tutor, that they didn't let you solo in unless you got a flying scholarship.
Right. Okay. So you solo in a glider.
And
so
I went and
soloing
glider
without an engine is the first off.
And I think, looking back on it, you just go, and now you're being taught as well by some pretty young people.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that some of the instructors were 16, 17, 18 year olds.
Wow. Yeah.
And that in itself, you know, looking back on it, as now I'm a bit older than that, I look back and I just go, oh my word, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But actually it's not, because these guys, again, they're so motivated, they're so passionate about what they do, and they have passed the course.
Yeah, that's it. So, they know what they're talking about.
And that's why I think, and funnily enough, actually, kind of compare that to now, flying an airliner, quite often you get passengers, and I'm sure you've had the same, passengers pop their head into the flight deck and go, well, you look far too young to be flying this plane.
They have an idea, don't they, of what they want to see behind the door.
Totally,
yeah.
Totally. And I had, the other day I had somebody look into the flight deck and she goes, what are you doing in there?
No.
And I was like,
goodness me.
I just flew you for 5 hours.
Yeah.
and she goes, not sure about that. I think you should be out here. And I was just like, okay. And you just kind of laugh it off. But I think the thing is looking back on those glider instructors, they've passed the course.
Yeah.
The same way that I've passed the course to fly a 320. And so I I've had to try and kind of change my mindset in that regard and just be like, you know what, if someone can pass the course, then they are fully deserving of that role.
Yeah, that's it. That exactly it. Yeah. We can't have these ideas of what we expect people to be before they're allowed to do these jobs. You know, it's people can prove that they can do the job or not. And that's the way it needs to be. Yeah.
Most definitely.
So flight simulation is obviously a big part of both you and I, our lives now and our online presence. So what was your first experience of flight simulation at home, and when did you sort of get into it?
Yeah, so I want to say it was like a Christmas or someone's, but I think it must have been a Christmas, because I distinctly remember in our living room, we had the family computer set up in the living room.
Those are the days.
Yeah. And I think it was my granddad bought my dad Microsoft Flight Simulator for Windows 95, and they spent hours, I want to say, like all out. They had dinner and then that was it, all afternoon, try and land this Cessna at Makesfield.
Yeah, the classic opening for everyone's flight simulation lives. Yeah.
So they were, you know, and they didn't have a joystick or anything. They were using mouse and keyboard trying to get this thing up and down, and and they just couldn't do it for hours and hours and hours. And then eventually it was coming and everything looked great. And it was like, yes, they're gonna finally land this aircraft. And they land. And do you remember like it used to like shatter into a million pieces?
Oh yeah, the screen could like crack, couldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so the whole aircraft just like completely, you know, exploded into these.
Oh, it breaks up. Yes, I do remember. Yeah.
And
they don't do that now, do they?
No, they don't. And basically forgotten to put the landing gear down.
Excellent.
And so that was it. Dad was like, I've had enough. Right, that's it. And so I kind of like got a bit into it from there, really.
So Flight Sim 1995 was your first sim.
That was, so I would have been really young. I mean, you know, they were. I wonder that come was. Yes, it came out in 95, maybe.
I assume so, yeah.
Similar. Or maybe 96 or something. Yeah, but, you know, I would have been very young at that point.
Yeah. Well, you've jumped me by one, because first one I used was 98. But
I never used that one.
Well, and I only used that one because I got 98. I think 2002 was already out, or maybe 2000, but I was given it by my uncle in a big box of old discs he had. He was into his computers, I found it in there, and I was already into my airplanes at this point. But once I put it into the computer and got it to work, that was oh my goodness, forever on the computer doing exactly the same sort of thing, trying to land and just experimenting, because I had no idea what any of the buttons were. I had no guides. I was far too young to figure any of this stuff out. There was no YouTube tutorials out there.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, and I think that. And certainly it's funny you should say that, because I imagine if I was back then with YouTube, if YouTube was a thing with all these tutorials, like,
yeah,
wow, I would have been hooked. Like,
you'd been on the ILS, auto landing.
Yeah, I would have, you know, would have shared, would have shared a flight school, like, ah, pff,
yeah,
I got this.
Yeah, it was very different. I mean, I spent years flying around Chicago from Meeksfield in the 737, which was the biggest plane 98 came with, because I was always about the airliners. And then my joystick wouldn't turn right. It would only turn left, because I never knew how to calibrate it. I didn't know that was a thing. So I certainly couldn't trim an airplane either. So, and I did that for hours and hours and hours, just doing left turns until I could line up with the runway.
So are you, so when you turn left onto an ILS in real life, like, is that easier for you now?
Yeah, well, I wonder if it is. I'll have to. Yeah, it takes less.
Circling approaches to the left, great. Yeah. Circling approaches to the right, not so great.
Not a fan. I'll let the other pilot do those. Yeah.
Do you? Funnily enough, so I know you're interviewing me, but do you have a preferred crosswind side?
I personally don't. A lot of people do. I don't know why I don't, but I've never. I can't consciously say which way I would prefer, but I know it if I get this right from people I've spoken to, it tends to be the side you sit on. You want the wind coming from that direction.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that's the same for me. So I prefer a wind from the right, but I think it's something to do with the fact that you have, because there's more window on the left. So you kind of look left and you feel you have a bigger field of view, maybe. I don't know, but yeah, I much prefer a crossing from the right-hand side.
I think you're absolutely right there. I think it's to do with, because so much on landing, all of our peripheral vision comes into play, even if we don't really realize it. Like if you have like glasses or sunglasses with big side parts to them, that are fine for looking forwards, but you don't realize they're blocking out your peripheral, that can actually make it more difficult to land, even if you haven't realized, and things like this. And I think if you're a lot of aircraft, I know the Airbus, we don't tend to drop a wing, but you might do a little bit. So what I'm referring to there is in a crosswind, we'll sort of fly the airplane sitting at an angle to the runway, pointing slightly into the wind. And then just before we land, we'll use the rudder to bring the nose round. But then if you can ever so slightly just drop a wing into wind, as it were, which will let you stay pointing down the runway and flying along the center line for a couple of seconds. And if you do that, but you're doing it from the other side, as it were, so you've dropped the other wing, your then peripheral vision just goes into the sky, or it lifts up. So I think you're on something there with the vision out that window makes it feel a bit different. Because you're then going to have sort of more sky out the window in your peripheral vision, and that's not much use for landing. Normally we're used to like grass and windsocks and things like that.
I definitely think there's something in that. I wonder, you know, for those who lived on both seats, if their preferred side switched. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, depending where they're sitting. Yeah, it's interesting. I've personally haven't noticed it, but it might be that
well,
if I was to look at my
trend,
I'll have a think. Yeah, I might find that all my landings, they're worse from one side or the other. But I don't know. So that was my flight sim experience of just going left circles,
just going
around.
left,
just going left. Yeah, in the 737 on that 2D panel.
And it's amazing. I did use 2004. I know my dad, because we had Windows 95 for a long time. And then they upgraded to Windows XP.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, well, if you want, we can go get you the newest one. And I was like, all right. So we went down to PC World or wherever
Fantastic.
It was at
yeah.
the time. And they were selling both 2004 and 2002.
Yeah.
And 2002 had a Concorde on it, on the front. And I was like, Dad, I want to get the one with the fast one.
Yeah.
And he was like, come on, like, you know, that's a slightly older game. You know, you might want to do 2004. And I was like,
no.
I want 2002. He was like, look, just trust me on this. So he got me 2004.
Ah, smart. Like, good decision.
So I had a bit of a play on that. And we set one up at the Air Cadets, actually, like to help kind of prepare people for the air experience flight so they get more out of it, which is quite clever.
Yeah. So you set up a flight simulator on a home computer at
in the
Air
squadron.
Cadets.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So we could kind of teach the six pack and, you know, say, oh, you know, what does this instrument do? What does this do and stuff? And it wasn't so much for basic handling. It was more for just understanding the instrument. So at least when you go flying, you know what you're looking at, I suppose.
Absolutely. It can totally change people's perspectives, even like you say, without the handling, because the handling is not going to be the same, is it? But the just knowing what they're looking at with the airspeed and the altimeter, because they're not natural sort of displays. They don't really relate to many things. Like an altimeter goes around and around itself, unlike a speedo on a car or something. So all of these things aren't known until you've had a chance to see them, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And so it just meant that when people went for their air experience flying, they were so much more, they were getting so much more out of it, because they go flying, okay, and I understand what these instruments are telling me.
Yeah.
Just kind of, I think it was certainly benefits in that regard. And then I kind of didn't touch it again, really. I did dig it out for when I was going through flight school. Because I was doing my multi-crew cooperation course on a 737.
Yep.
So me and my flying partner kind of learn our scan flows using the simulator.
Yeah, you have an actual a visual representation of the flight deck. You can start to get an idea of where you're going to be looking
and
for
also
things.
You know what happens when you push a button.
Yeah.
So that was really helpful. And then, so kind of, yeah, as I said, it was kind of like bits of flights from here and there, like when there was a purpose to it. And then kind of put it all away until COVID, really.
Similar to me, then, really. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when COVID happened and I found myself sat at home, I was like, hold on a second. Do you remember there was that flight sim thing? And especially because I'd felt my skills just not fading away, but if you do something every, so I driving a car, I don't know if anyone's ever, you know, you drive a car every day, then you go on holiday for 2 or 3 weeks, then you come back and you just sit in your car and you're like, oh, this is going to take a couple of minutes to just get used to this again.
Get comfortable again.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I felt every time I was going to work during COVID. I was like, okay, I know I can do this, but it just feels a bit strange.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was like, right, that's it. And jumped into, basically went on Steam and downloaded Flight Sim X.
Flight Sim X was what we came back to at the start of the pandemic.
Yeah, just the Steam edition on my laptop.
Yeah, that's what I had. Yeah, because I went from 98 to X. I went 98. Then I had 2002 for a short while, and then X came out, and I got X. And then my computer couldn't run it at all, so I went back to 2002. But
right.
but yeah, X was a long running one, and it's amazing that in 2020, then that was the one that still one of the ones that was just recommended on Steam. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And that was before 2020 came out, though.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
So that was, yeah, what, April, March, April 2020? So I was flying, I downloaded the Aerosoft 321.
Excellent. Yeah, I had that.
Yeah, and just, you know, installed that. And I was basically just keep myself, you know, just feeling, remembering scan flows and bits and pieces, really. That's all I did, to be honest. And then I discovered VATSIM, and that was like, whoa, this is cool.
Yeah, VATSIM was something that it's I knew about it for my entire time simming, and I've been simming since, you know, like yourself, back in the I probably wasn't simming until the noughties, as it were, but even so I knew about VATSIM. I tried and failed several times to connect to it, and then I moved away from sims for a little while. So when I came back in the pandemic, I got myself onto VATSIM for the first time and was blown away. Quite something,
yeah. That's, I was just like, this is scarily accurate. And I think the thing that makes it more authentic is when you go to other countries on VATSIM, their controllers have the same accents, mannerisms, things they do that the real world controllers do as well.
Yeah, they all take their home airports like very seriously. They know what the normal arrivals are and the phraseology that airport will use. It's great, isn't it?
And the style, and just, yeah, I was just so blown away by it.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of flying again during COVID, just on VATSIM. And then somebody heard me on London Control and sent me a DM. And said, oh, you should come and watch me. I'm streaming on Twitch.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. I don't know why that is, but I'll come and say hi. And you had to make an account. And I was like, well, my name's Katie and I'm a pilot, so that'll do. Then said hi. I still didn't really know what it was. I thought it was kind of similar to Zoom, where you just like post a link to somebody and they'll be able to come and watch your channel.
Right.
I didn't realize it was kind of you can find anyone on there. I didn't realize it was kind of like YouTube in that regard.
Yeah, it's a big world.
yeah, exactly. And so we were just doing group flights, and he was like, oh, you should stream. I was like, oh, okay, like, how do I do that? Set me up with OBS. And then kind of I didn't realize until people were coming into my chat that I was like, who are these people? How did they find my channel? And then I discovered that actually this is more of a live streaming platform that you put yourself out there to the world,
So it
and it
was
kind of went from there, really.
Yeah, because you've had your fantastic success on Twitch, obviously, and your channel grew to or has it grow? I say channel. Is it a channel? Channel, I suppose.
I still don't know. Probably
Twitch profile or page has grown because of the quality of your streams, which, and I have dropped in on a few, and yeah, you really take on some big challenges. I'm sure I saw Innsbruck. I've seen all sorts of single engine stuff.
I'm not sure if that makes me stupid or not, because it's a challenge. I mean, as you'll know, like, it's a challenge when there's two of you working through it in a simulator methodically. When you have one of you, you can't flick switches naturally. You have to move panel view, click them, and all that sort of stuff. And you have Twitch chat as well, and you're explaining what you're doing.
Yeah.
It certainly presents an opportunity for a bit of overload.
Yeah, but like going back, you said I don't think it's a daft idea at all to be doing. I think it's you present it really, really nicely, and it's that thing of. It's something I wanted to ask you as well, actually, which is what do you think about using Sims for practice or training? And it sounds like for sort of routine flying, you were saying earlier, and for keeping your head in the game, as it were, of flying, that it's quite useful for you. You find it useful, and I definitely agree. And how do you find it for doing those technical things? Because already, as you've said about the capacity problem, which is the most notable thing, which is for me as well, trying to click on things on the screen, dealing with the chat, and then you've also got the fact that the airplane in the sim may not do exactly what you expect or the real one would. And
yeah, it's a really interesting one, actually, because I find it really helpful, certainly with non-normals and kind of prioritizing tasks and just generally kind of thinking about if you run a scenario in the sim, things will inevitably happen that you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
And that kind of is really helpful, I find, because in reality, if something happens, my brain now has a few more things in there that's like, okay, have we considered this? Potentially it could happen, you know, as a consequence. And so I found that's really been amazing, actually, in terms of the sim to drive my my curiosity into so when things happen in the sim, whether it's, you know, accurate, surreal thing or not, it forces me to go and look into the books. Or the next time I go into the level D sims, and I'll say, you know, the instructor says, oh, is there anything you want to look at? But actually, would you mind just if we just have a quick look at this? Because, you know, I'm just interested to what the aircraft would do. And I really think that it's really helpful. I think, you know, adding VAT sim, adding the stream and stuff adds to the level of the level of unpredictability that causes me to kind of have questions. Often I come off my stream and I'm like, okay, things happened there that I wasn't expecting. Why did they happen? And then I'll go and look them up. And whether it's someone's asked me a question about something, or the aircraft's done something, or, you know, so it's actually really helps focus my own training. So I'm not using the sim as a training aid. I'm using it more of a tool to
it's almost like a motivator, isn't it?
and just say, you know, to kind of help me guides where I'm looking in the books and what I'm looking at, rather than taking it as gospel, because I think there is that danger, certainly in flight sim, is that, you know, well, I can fly the Phoenix, I can fly the FS Labs, I can fly the PMDG, and therefore I could do the real thing. And I think there is that danger that you put too much of a weighting on it.
Totally agreed. I mean, these are amazing add-ons, and for normal procedures, a lot of them are incredibly close. But when it comes to things like on the talking Airbus specifically here, like the ECAM and so on, these things change all the time on the real aircraft. So it'd be daft to start assuming what's going to happen in the sim is accurate to the real airplane, because the fact is the real airplane could have been updated yesterday and you wouldn't know. But
yeah, and I mean, you know, certainly, I mean, on our fleet at the moment, we've got multiple different fits of aircraft. So what happens, you get into the aircraft, one of the first things you do is you look and you go, right, what has this aircraft got?
Yeah.
And what doesn't it have? And what FWC standard does it have? Does it have this fitted? Does it have that fitted? And so it makes you kind of have to not fly differently. You fly them the same, you know, regardless. But in terms of if there are certain failures, it's like, okay, does this have this fitted? And therefore, if so, then we'll do this. If not, then we'll do this. And I think that you don't have that in flight sim. So if you had, if you were flying the Phoenix and had some sort of failure, you could never guarantee that that the way that you resolve the Phoenix is the way you resolve the real aircraft. So in terms of using it as a way to, as a prioritize tasks or run some sort of non-normal scenario, then it's great. Knowing that it's not, that you won't necessarily regurgitate that same solution to the same problem if it was in the real world, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. It's having that healthy respect for what it actually is. So yeah, I totally agree with you on the way the things changing around you is a really useful thing to sort of force your mind to think differently as you try and solve these problems in the sim. And something I found really useful has been VATSIM for that, which is introduced a level of dynamic change into flights that I otherwise wouldn't have. Because, for example, flying approaches in my streams, I set up an arrival and then off we go. We're going to go and fly that arrival. And if there's no controller or VATS in there to stop me, that's what I'm going to do. And once I introduce VATS in onto that, it's a whole world of, well, I can't take that for granted now. I might set it all up in the box. And then halfway through the descent, they change runways, because that's something that happens all the time flying for real.
Yeah. And that's what I love about, VATS in that regard, is the fact that you kind of have to prepare for other scenarios and also manage the change. And so I think that's actually quite beautiful in a sense, because you can show your stream exactly the things you go through in the real world. The only thing that I struggle with is because it's just me.
Yes.
So you can't be like, okay, so in reality, if we get a runway change, you know, the person flying the aircraft would continue to fly the aircraft. The pilot monitoring would probably go and change the box, and then the pilot flying, you might switch over, pilot monitoring would have a look and just confirm that you know, makes sense. And so it's kind of like a things you can't show, but it certainly shows the workload management side.
We can show how busy it gets, but yeah, it doesn't show, because it sounds, when we talk about it here and when you talk about it on stream, or when I talk about it on streams, it's easy to go, and then of course you'd breathe the other person. But this stuff is actually the most important part of all, is how you're interacting with the other pilot, and how you're both, because you can both sit there and you both hear, okay, the runway's changed. And then you can both have two totally different routes of how you're going to solve that, and what you're going to do, and where you're going to put the airplane, and how much speed you're going to have to lose. One of you might think, oh, well, let's get the speed on and let's descend down. And then we're ready for the shorter approach. The other one might think, oh, let's slow down. I don't want to get there too quickly because I need time now to solve this. Maybe we'll enter a hold. And until this sort of stuff is resolved, we've got two people coming up with different ideas. And all of this sort of stuff, which is so complex, it's so much of what training in aviation is these days. And sadly, there's just no way to, well, I haven't found a really useful way of getting that across on a stream.
I've done a couple of streams with Airbus for the win. So we did like a multi-crew thing, which is really cool, especially because he was a captain. I'm a first officer, both of us in the 320, both working for the same airline. So it was really natural to do. But even that, I mean, we kind of set something up in his kind of a, it wasn't using, you know, your controls or anything like that. It was in a very Beth and I cannot divulge to the wide world. I'll tell you off stream. but that was really cool. But the hardest part of it was still, I mean, the CRM was really good to be able to brief and discuss and talk.
Yeah.
But it's still not quite the same.
No, that's definitely hard to do.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I wish there was more control over.
Yeah.
That you could, you know, set something up in a multi-crew environment, especially because airliner flying is entirely about multi-crew.
Yeah.
So it's a shame that the simulators tend to be geared towards single pilot.
I quite like when we see attempts at a co-pilot. So we usually in add-ons get things like speed call-outs and so on, which are quite nice. I do like those. An example would be the PMDG's DC-6. I don't know if you flew that.
No.
So on the DC-6, to start the engines, you have to crank them round, and one of the pilots or the engineer would, was there an engineer or two pilots? Anyway, one of the pilots would look at the propeller and say how many times it's rotated round, and you have to do a certain number before you could start it. But of course, already in a sim, how'd you do that on your own? What they did was they had the auto call out. So the other pilot would say 3, 6, 9. And it was really just a neat little solution to a multi-crew sort of problem. So I love seeing things like that in sims. Another example would be in Digital Combat Simulator. I don't know if you've used that at all.
I used it like once.
Yeah.
And
it's
I got
a whole
confused.
Other world. Yes.
I was like, I just want to shoot people. And I couldn't do that. And I got annoyed.
It took hours. It took me a week, I think, of just taking an hour or two a day to get the F-14 started up and in the air.
Right.
But I absolutely love it. I think it's great. But in that, the F-14's a two crew aircraft as well.
Your navigator,
radar. I think navigator is a UK thing or certain aircraft.
Oh, right, okay.
It's all very specific. It's it's a whole other world of acronyms.
A weapon systems operator or something.
Oh, they're called
maybe
a RIO, which is
basically
radar intercept
goose.
Officer.
Is that what I'm?
I'm going to look this up now because I can't not know that.
But am I right in saying it's like goose in like Top Gun?
Exactly, it's goose. Yeah.
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 Right.
So the RIO is Radar Intercept Officer. Yes, I got that right. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So they're in the back and they are running the radar and looking out for the enemies and so on. But they can also, they're heavily involved in the startup, in the IRS alignment and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So what Heatblurt did was they have an AI sort of character sitting there that will talk to you, and it will, you can tell it to do things through a sort of quick access menu. Like, oh, can you set up the IRS is to a certain navigation standard. Can you point the radar in this direction or point it up or down? And if you get into a dogfight, it will call out enemies around you and say like 3 o'clock, hi, approaching fast and stuff like this. It's very
yes,
good.
That's really helpful in terms of that. It'd be quite cool if that was something in the airline world to be.
Yeah.
I know there's FS2 crew, but.
Yeah, there, as I was going to say, yeah, I haven't used it though.
I've seen it, and I think all credit to them, and it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
But it's still a bit sort of turn AP on or whatever the command is. It's basically voice activated controls.
Right.
So you're still having to tell your co-pilot or your captain or whoever to do something. Whereas in reality, it would be like, oh, it's getting a bit warm in here. Like, you have to start the AP. Yeah, sounds good. All right. Or, you know, or for example, the ground crew will come and knock on the side of the aircraft to take away the ground power. And like, oh, no, hold on. And then that'll also be your pilot. So the captain or co-pilot, one of them will press start the AP just automatically because, oh, they want to take the ground power. So I think there's
a bit of a dance, isn't there, between the two pilots that you get used to in each airline will have a certain dance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that would be quite cool if that was something, because like I said, FS2 crew, brilliant.
Yeah,
but it'd be cool if it was taken to the next level of just that kind of having someone who had some sort of initiative, but also you could interact with in a way that is not necessarily standard phraseology, but you could, because AI is incredible these days, right?
Yeah, it'd be really interesting.
So some that would be quite cool, I think. You know,
although we don't want to see it get too good, otherwise they might try and put it on a real airplane and get rid of that.
And then me and you'll be working in Tesco or something. Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with working in Tesco, but I like my current job and I'd like to keep it if that's all right.
Yes, yeah, it's exactly. It's something we, Well, I think it's fortunately a long way off before they can start certifying any sort of AI to press any buttons on an airplane. But
well, they kind of did it in a sense with the flight engineer, didn't they? And turned it into an ECAM. So hopefully there won't be a
Yep. More automated systems that can monitor themselves. Yeah, it's true. It has made progress. Luckily, that progress stopped 30 years ago and we haven't seen it get much further. I say stopped, it hasn't stopped. Some things like TCAS are now flown by the autopilot. So, you know, one day imagine GPWSs will be flown by the autopilot, and soon enough you could do the whole thing, even emergencies, with the autopilot. But
I think it's really interesting because I definitely think that the more automation there is, as long as it's used in the correct manner, can be really good.
Yeah.
For example, like, you know, if you're auto TCAS, like you say, like, you know, the aircraft is going to fly a TCAS perfectly every time with the autopilot in.
Yeah.
Whereas a human pilot may not quite fly it as accurately as the autopilot would. Fine. Yeah. However, the one thing that humans are really good at doing that a computer could not do and certainly couldn't do in this day and age is things like weather avoidance.
Yeah.
Or, you know, as you say, GPWSs and things like that. At the moment, I think if there's various different, you know, you'll look on the weather radar and you'll go, is that something we want to avoid or not?
Yep.
And we take an interpretation on whether it's a storm or whether it's just a bit of rain. And even though they both show similarly on a screen, as pilots, we use our experience to know the difference.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think a computer could do that. And they'd end up either flying straight through a thunderstorm or avoiding a little rain shower.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's absolutely that experience is, it really does come in, and everyone has, all pilots have different levels of experience. And then we have two pilots who can then combine that into a pragmatic answer. And then that event will then influence both of those two pilots' interpretation of the risk for next time. And then this is builds up and up and up over years and across all the pilot community, as it were, and that in the world. And that's how we do that sort of thing, like weather avoidance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, the classic thing with the automated systems is, you take off and you hit a flock of birds and you have one engine on fire and one engine fails. So the computer will tell you, we'll shut down the engine that's on fire, you know, and then you've got no engines, sort of thing.
And I think I think that the way you can illustrate it as well is you look at the QRH and there's a list of, or the FCOM as well, a list of things that can go wrong according to the manufacturer.
Yep.
But there's also, as you say, that scenario where, take Sully, for example.
Yep.
There is no procedure in the FCOM or the QRH for what happens when you hit a flock of Canada geese at a really low altitude after takeoff and there's nowhere to go apart from a river. There is no procedure. And they did the best they could with that scenario. And so I think, had there been no pilots that day, what would the computer have done?
Yeah, how could it have chosen that path?
And how could any programmer program that solution?
Yeah, aim for the river.
And that's the thing. I think that there's an element of, when it comes to pilots, that the human nature has such a strong influence. I think in the future maybe there will be, you know, pilotless things around, but I think it's a very, very long way off, and I don't think in my lifetime it'll be a thing.
No, I agree. I think it's a long way off. Now, you know, we could be proved wrong, and in 5 years they could be pilotless commercial airliners, but I doubt it as well. And for me, it's going back to, we talk about VATSIM, adding a dynamic level into the situation. There's so much changing all the time when you're flying. And my favorite example of that is when I tried to do a video on when to descend, or when I did a video on fly-by-wire did their first attempt, or they started to integrate VNAV. And everyone was saying, why is there no VNAV? Why is there no VNAV? But then I was talking about it and in the video, and it was, you sort of think, goodness me, the amount of things that can change just in planning a descent. So if the tailwind is a couple of knots higher, the weight was a little bit higher, the CG was in a slightly different place, the tropper pause was in a different place, the engine anti-ice had to be on or off, the wing anti-ice had to be on or off, and then the Q&H was slightly different. So the change onto Q&H was a larger gap. All of these things could put you, you could be hundreds to a thousand of feet high mm-hmm. by the time you get down to the airport, which is no good. And, yeah, and we can see that. And that's our job, as it were, is monitoring this stuff.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, you've only got plenty of passengers will know this, but how often are you sat on a plane as a passenger and you see the speed brakes pop up
mm-hmm.
On the descent? And that is because things change, and certainly, you know, air traffic control might, you know, you could have, just an example, you could have the most like perfect descent profile. You think, oh, this is brilliant, this is working great. And then air traffic control say, you know, your call sign, and then reduce speed 250 knots. And you're like, oh, well, that puts you closer to your velocity of minimum drag. So therefore you have less drag on the aircraft. Oh, we're going to get high now. So you have to then use a bit of speed brake, or, you know, so there's things that change from whether it's air traffic or they'll, you know, as you said it earlier, but they'll shorten your track miles or something, you know. There is no, every flight you do, you have an idea of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it rarely happens. And I think there's a phrase, I think it's the military that came up with it, but no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of true for aviation. You know, you have an idea of what's going to happen, and then things change and you have to work around it.
Yeah.
I think that's where the human brain comes in, really.
Totally agreed. Yeah, absolutely. So we were talking a lot about flight simulation. So my next question is, of course, you've done some work coding or developing in flight simulation. Mm-hmm. So what led you to that? And had you done any of that before? And what sort of things have you worked on?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of coding in the past. I mean, so when I was about 15, one of my teachers, IT teacher, was like, I'm going to start doing HTML lessons in at lunchtimes on a Thursday or whatever day it was. If you want to come along, you're more than welcome. And I was like, that sounds quite interesting. So yeah. I went along and learned a little bit. And at the time, it was during the world of everyone had their own, it's kind of before social media, but it was like everyone had their own little page, or at the time it was free webs for us. So it was like, you just had like a page that you could, you know, modify using kind of Twitter.
A MySpace.
Yeah, it's a similar thing, right? But that was HTML as editor on there. But I was like, oh, I want to customize it more than I'm allowed using their tools. So I then started writing code and changing my page that way.
Fantastic.
And I just got into coding from there, really, and never just continued to build on like, oh, that's cool. And then I did a few websites for people and they said, oh, can you do this? And I'm like, well, I didn't really know how to, but yeah, all right, I'll go and discover how to do it. And that kind of went from there, really. And then through helping Phoenix from a testing perspective, I got chatting with one of the developers about my coding background. And he said, well, you know, they're like gauges within flight sim are mostly like HTML gauges.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so a lot of them are. It kind of varies, I think, but a lot of them can be. So he said, well, would you be able to make an EFB? And I was like, I mean, it involves working with some of the systems within the aircraft, but as long as you guys can, you know, help me with that, then yeah, I don't see why not. So I had a chat with Amir and it was, this is a great idea. So and the team I had a bit of time off work at the time, so I kind of was at a bit of a loose end anyway. So it was just quite good timing, really, so I could sit and work on this project with some really, really good people, really exciting people, and also on something I was motivated about, because I wanted to bring a 320 to Microsoft Flight Simulator because we didn't have a 320 CO in the sim at all. So
yeah,
and there were no, aside from the fly by wire, there were no airliners at the time.
No, it was it's fantastic add-on, obviously, the Phoenix, and the EFB is a big part of that. It's so not to take anything away from the rest of the aircraft, but the EFB is also, you know, it lives up to the standard of the airplane. It's really great, and it was noticeable as soon as the aircraft released how much people enjoyed the EFB that you did put together, because it's I love things like the little detail of like the charging cable, and that took me a while to figure out. Also, the pin code to get in took me a while to figure out. You could press the Touch ID.
Yeah.
And then I really like the shortcut links that drop down, so you can swap between apps without having to go back to the home screen.
So with those, actually, it's quite interesting, because so that was sort of as a developer.
Yeah.
My aim, and by the way, this was not just me, you know, there's a whole team of people, and certainly the user, the EFB has to integrate with the aircraft systems, and so this is definitely a team effort. So although I did code and design the EFB, it was as I said, it was not just me sitting there on my own. There was a team of people working but starting with the shortcuts, so I created the EFB to be as realistic as possible. So I was, you know, I said, well, we don't have a shortcut bar in the real world. Like, so.
Yeah.
And the feedback from the testers was, it's kind of annoying to have to close an app to open another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, yeah, it is annoying, isn't it? You know, that's what we have in real life. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And then I kind of mellowed a little bit. I was like, all right, let's try this. And I'm so glad that we did, because when I use it, I'm very much, you know, just like, okay, yeah, the shortcut menu is really helpful.
It comes back to like what we were saying earlier about doing things in the sim. It's always another level over what it is in real life. So pressing a button in the sim, you can't just press the button. You've got to scroll up, find it, get the right click spot and click on it, and then scroll, move the camera back down again. And I suppose it's similar to the EFB, which is just a few pixels on the screen at some points, isn't it? So yeah, yeah, it's paid off. It's really great. And so much power to it.
Yeah. And it got to a point where, because as I said, I was off work, so I was, you know, spent quite a lot of time working. Well, I mean, I can do this, so I mean, why not? Like, you know, the whole charging thing. I remember doing the whole thing where I was like, okay, well, let's have it charging and let's have it discharge. And then I basically had to say to the modeling team and the system guys, like, okay, so I've created this thing where the battery charges and discharges the same as a lithium ion battery does in terms of the curve, and you know, that's all modeled in there. So after we'd created this EFB that could be charged and discharged, there was also the challenge of, well, what if the aircraft is powered down, but the EFB is still plugged in? Will the EFB be charging or not? Well, in reality, it wouldn't. So therefore, maybe that needs, and it's called me out in real life. Sorry, in real life, as in on the stream, where I've set it, because I often set the sim up, you know, a few hours prior to going live and just have it sat there while I work on other stuff. And I've come back and gone live and looked at my EFB, and it's been dead because the aircraft's been cold and dark.
it's great. Such a level of detail. And it's good fun.
Yeah. And I think it got to the point where, you know, developing things, it was like, right, you know what? Can we do this? Yes. Should we do it? Absolutely.
Yeah. Why not?
And I think it became very much a project of passion. And that can be said for the whole aircraft. Things that, you know, if they're going to add value and we can do it, then we're going to do it, you know? And I think that was a testament to the developers and the things they're working on, you know, now is fab. So really excited for the future of the project, really.
And you mentioned there something you're working on now. So what's next for you in flight simulation land?
Yeah, so I am working on, there's a couple of things that I've kind of working on, and certainly when it comes to my streams, it's become less because I've been working quite hard on these other projects. One of which is my own project that I've been working with a handful of different developers within Flight Simulation. So kind of trying to liaise with them to basically pull this thing together, which I'm massively excited about. And
Oh, fantastic.
it's,
Yeah.
I say, I can't say a huge amount about it just because it's quite early days.
Okay.
But if it goes the way that I am expecting it to and planning it to, then it's going to be absolutely incredible. And I'm super excited to bring it to the community. And I say the last time I was this excited was for the Phoenix EFB. So yeah, just I guess I'll just leave it there at
Exciting
that.
stuff. Yeah. Well, we
Yeah.
saw what you were capable of with the Phoenix EFE, and I'm sure everyone's very excited to hear about it, but it's great to know that you're working on something next for us all. That's yeah, we'll
Yeah,
look
and
forward to that.
I guess I just want people to know as well that, just because my streams have waned a little bit, I am still very much here and very much working on things. So it's just in a slightly different capacity than I was before. Like before, I was doing a lot of streaming and showcasing and that sort of thing. But certainly since doing the work for Phoenix and a couple of other developers, I think I definitely enjoyed the development side a lot. So yeah, I think, my stream is continuing and will continue. But it's going to be more of a, there'll be a purpose to those streams rather than, okay, it's a Friday afternoon, let's just go live and do a little A to B flight. It's going to be more, it'll have purpose.
Right. Oh, excellent. Looking forward to it. Yeah, brilliant. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. So some of the standard questions that I ask guests on the show, you're only the second guest actually, so but I will try and make standard questions we'll carry on with here. So what's your favorite aircraft? And it can be one you've flown or one you want to fly or one from history, whatever you fancy, or the future, I suppose, if you have one in mind.
Yeah, so I think that my favorite aircraft that I've flown would be the Seneca.
Seneca.
And I don't, I think that's primarily just because it was the first glimpse I got of what I currently do. So flying a Seneca,
Your first multi-engine sort of flying on instruments, sort of flying, I guess.
yeah, like in the airways in the UK, like
Yeah.
hearing, your Easy's, your Speedbirds, your Tom Jets and all that, in the same airways as these other airliners, and just I'm flying the same procedures as them. I remember on my instrument rating exam, I was following a Ryanair 737 into Bournemouth, and that you kind of go, wow,
Yeah.
I'm doing an ILS behind Ryanair. I remember going into Birmingham in the Seneca, and there was the 380 holding short for us, and just like I think
Fantastic.
that when you're amongst those big aircraft, that was, I think, the moment I was like, oh my God, I am actually going to be an airline pilot if I pass
Yeah,
this.
you're suddenly you're perilously close at that point, aren't you? And I remember the same. I flew down an approach behind a Q400, which I then went on to fly. Yeah, no, it's yeah, it's funny. So the Seneca, which is so the Seneca is a twin engine piston aircraft by Piper, for anyone listening who isn't familiar with it. I don't know how many Senecas you see around, but they are quite common in flight training. But yeah, they I really enjoyed it. I flew the Seneca as well, and I also enjoyed it as an aircraft. It's
And it was nice to the passenger as well. So I don't know if people know about how flight school tends to work, but you tend to be buddied with somebody. And then you'll go off and do your lesson, or they'll do their lesson, and then you'll land and then you'll switch over. So when you're not flying, you're observing. And you're sitting in the back, and in the back of a Seneca, I want to say there's four seats, kind of two facing forwards, two facing backwards, and a little table. So you feel like you're on your own little private jet. It's
You've got enough
great.
space in it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful.
It's Barney's favorite was the what did he say? Diamond 42, which was so funny how these
It
GA
looks like an
planes are getting
insect,
into
though,
this theme.
doesn't it?
I was expecting someone to say, yeah, like Concorde or the Blackbird or something,
I
but
think, yeah, in terms of airliner, as an airline pilot,
Yeah, is there anything you'd
I
like
don't
to
get,
fly?
I don't know. I think I maybe maybe the 380 just because it's so massive.
It's an amazing machine.
So I would have loved to have flown the 747. I think that would have been, it's a real shame that that's sort of in its, certainly within the UK, there aren't, unless you're going to go and do cargo, there's no real airlines that
No,
fly
as
them
ever
anymore.
in Europe, we tend to lose these aircraft a bit earlier than America, who keep them going longer. So we 747s are far and few between now. One of mine that I would love to have done was the 757, as we talked about earlier, but that's pretty much gone out of Europe. There's a few left, but
Unless you don't go work for Iceland there or something.
yeah,
I mean,
that's
maybe
it.
you do. Maybe that's, you know,
Maybe.
that's your big secret.
And they've obviously they're going for the 73 Max now. They've got
Are they?
those,
Is that
haven't
what
they?
they're doing?
I think they have some of those now. Yeah, it's but there we go. But yeah, 380 is so Seneca
Think so.
2 or 380. It's one or the other.
Seneca, actually, Seneca 5
Seneca 5,
is,
sorry, that was
yes,
the name of the
we were the posh kids with the fancy screens.
Seneca 5, really lovely.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so it was quite cool to have like G1000 and all that sort
Oh
of
wow,
stuff.
yeah. I mean, I've only ever heard of Seneca 2, so I didn't even know I didn't know it went to 5.
So the flight school, I want to say they got the Seneca 5 maybe in like 2014 or something, so a couple of
Right.
years before I was flying them. They were quite new and nice. So
Nice. Oh, very nice. Yeah, very
yeah.
good. Going back to simulation then, what's your favorite aircraft add-on
I mean, I would have to say the
over the
Phoenix
years?
V20.
Yeah, fair enough.
Having said that, I think the aircraft that I really went, wow, I can't believe flight simulation is at this level,
Yeah.
was the FS Labs when I first installed it and went and just and literally did a flight. And it was to the point where I was like, this is absolutely insane how detailed this aircraft is. Now, you know, Phoenix is at a similar level, and the Aerosoft as well, I think, was also pretty high fidelity,
Yeah, I
you
liked
know.
the Aerosoft a lot, yeah.
So, but I think the moment, and I think that's probably because it was the first high fidelity aircraft that I'd ever used,
Yeah.
and also having the experience of the real thing to compare it to, I was genuinely like, oh my word, this, how is flight simulation at this level? So I have to say that kind of holds a special place in my heart. And but the in terms of the one, I think that I'm just like, this is really quite cool. Now in 2023 is the Phoenix, I think.
The
And
Phoenix.
certainly there's a lot of excitement about what's coming in the future as well. So.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic add-on. So yeah, it's not no surprise really, I suppose, because it well
And I
deserves
promise
the
I'm not
spot there.
biased.
Yeah.
My favorite EFB in flight simulation is.
Excellent. Yeah. It's no. It is. The Phoenix is it's just super. What about your favorite approach? Is there an approach? I get asked this a lot on streams, and I always struggle to wrap my brain for like an approach I really like. So, do you have any? You don't. One is quite difficult to narrow down, but if you have any, or a couple that you like, you enjoy flying.
Yeah, I think ones that I've done in the real world, I always enjoy
Yeah.
going down to Funchal.
Yeah, Funchal,
I
yeah.
think, you know, that is, it's a world famous approach, and being able to, you know, be at the controls of an aircraft going into there is pretty, you know, it's captain's only landing, so I won't be doing the landing, but you know, to be flying into an airport that is so famous, I think is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I went into Innsbruck as well. That was very cool. And of course, Gibraltar is just such a.
So you like
I
the challenging
enjoy
ones.
the. I think I enjoy them because they're just a bit different from
Yeah.
a 3-degree ILS. It's just a bit more of a challenge. And then I have to say, in terms of the sim, I really enjoy going into some of the really difficult places. So I enjoy doing things like Paro,
Yeah. I knew
Kamloops
that was coming.
Nui, like all of those. And they're just good fun because, you know, you're in the sim, there's no jeopardy. If you know, if you make a mistake and it all goes horribly wrong, well, it's fine. It's the sim, you just restart it. apart from maybe people will be laughing at you, but the one I really enjoy is Samos. I don't know if you've done that one.
I think someone's recommended it. I don't think I've done
it's
it.
It's really good. It's kind of similar to Funchal in the sense that you need to fly over a pier at a certain altitude, and then you kind of make a sweeping right turn, and then you go over some shed that's got a white roof at about 400 feet, and then then you kind of last minute rolling out into the runway heading and stuff like that. So that's I really enjoyed that. I enjoy the challenge of the handling of those. But the only thing that frustrates me with the sim in that regard is the fact that unless you have some sort of eye tracker or track IR or you're in VR, it's really hard to kind of like be able to judge those final turns.
Yeah, visual flying in The Sims it's hard. And it's hard even in the full motion level D Sims, isn't it? Where the visuals don't wrap behind your flight deck, typically.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are all, yeah. So you like the challenging ones, definitely then.
I do. I'm an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah. But that is the best thing about The Sim, isn't it? To get to go and see some of these crazy approaches that very few pilots are qualified to fly in real life.
And interestingly enough, enjoy them. As well, no, you're totally correct. And also, you talked earlier a little bit about how you use Sim to benefit you.
Yeah.
And if there's an airport I've never been to before in real life and I see it on my roster, then I'll often go and check it out in The Sim, because not only is it really helpful from what's the layout of this airport and that sort of stuff, but often in terms of terrain, energy management, and just having a bit of an appreciation. Then when you go and do it in real life, especially because the graphics are so good in Microsoft Flight Simulator, when you're coming down the approach, you kind of feel like you've been there before. So you kind of find yourself in a bit more of a comfortable position.
How interesting. Yeah. It is incredible, isn't it? The general scenery in Microsoft Flight Simulator, how good
Absolutely.
It is.
Totally.
I'm not counting the default airports, which I find lacking.
Yeah, me too.
But
the general kind of
area,
the topographical,
amazing.
All that sort of stuff is pretty impressive.
It's amazing. And I find, just like you said there, it's the energy management and the timings. It's like if you've got a bit of a challenging sort of VOR, where one would be like Skiathos, where the VOR is off the island. So you're going to fly from an outbound on the VOR, then you make a right turn back around and intercept. Well, how long does that actually take? Could you do it flap one, or do you need to be flap two? And all of these sorts of things. I wouldn't lock myself into an idea based on the sim, because there could be something fundamentally wrong about my home simulator.
Totally.
I will ultimately be relying on, because airlines will have briefs for these airports, especially ones that are slightly more challenging. Mm-hmm. And you're going to go with that. And obviously that's going to be overriding, but it can give you an idea of actually this is quite a short downwind leg, or the turn is a bit, is a little bit earlier than you thought, and things like that. It can be quite good for. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. And I just think like I said, it puts you into that position where you just feel just a bit more comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a really nice position to be in. Like, especially, airlines change their routes all the time.
Yeah.
They're opening new routes, closing others. And, I know there's certainly in my airline, there's a couple of places that are new this summer. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to end up going there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to check them out in the sim beforehand. And that's a really nice tool to have.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because like
yeah.
I said, you still do all the stuff you need to do for the airline in terms of, reading the briefs and all that sort of stuff. But
it's just on top of that.
Yeah, just having a little go in on the desktop sim is definitely like helpful. So
yeah. I love the way the Microsoft Flight Simulator, I talk about this all the time on streams, but it's the way the houses look right. The right sort of the right color roofs, the right sort of buildings, and the right sort
and
of trees. All this stuff.
Even depending on what country you're flying over.
You're in Italy, it looks like Italy.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely bizarre, isn't it? Like,
it's incredible.
It's, the way, especially, kind of thinking back to the initial exposure I had to Flight Sim of 95, where every cloud was a big cube in the sky.
Yeah,
and,
that's it. Oh, yeah, cubes,
the,
yeah.
yeah, and the sea was a load of squares, like different shaded squares and stuff. And I think you compare that now to how it is. It's just come on so far,
Yeah, absolutely agreed. Next question then is, what for you has been the best part of your job flying? What do you like the most about it?
I think the fact that every single day I go to work is a new challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may have done the route 100 times before, but you have a different crew, a different set of weather,
yep.
different aircraft, as we talked before, in terms of the fit of the aircraft,
yeah.
different flight crew as well, in terms of, you know, you have to build a rapport with somebody that you may not necessarily have met before. And just different challenges just every day. And I think the satisfaction of safely delivering people from A to B is quite nice. And then also, you know, learning about myself and learning more and more about the aircraft I fly. I think it's a consistent learning curve.
Yeah, it's so much changing all the time.
I think it's not the kind of job that you can ever stagnate in.
No.
And I like the idea of the fact that, you know, going forwards, there's other challenges, whether it's, you know, changing aircraft type, becoming a captain, or all these different things that you're going to continually progress in your career. And I think that is the most satisfying part of my job. So
fantastic. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That talking about stagnating thing is like, I've had it before where I feel like I'm relatively on top of things in terms of the recent changes and so on. And then you start to get a nagging feeling like, oh, maybe I'm not, I need to get on that. And and then you go and check and stuff's changed, and you can spend quite a lot of time sort of catching up or even reviewing something that you haven't looked at for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense in your mind starts to build up. The longer you leave it from having done that, you know that you're not where you need to be. And it's just shows how it's moving around you. If you don't keep up with it, it's going to do it anyway. And you have to, you just have to. And it's a nice part of the job.
I find that satisfying. I've always been the kind of person who wants to, you know, continually progress. And, you know, you can see that with my development work, or whether it's flying or streaming or anything like that. I've always wanted to push boundaries and keep learning, keep going and stuff. So this job definitely like brings that,
encourages that. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, what about flying has been the biggest difference then to what you expected when you set out to be a pilot?
I think I expected to do more about operating the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think actually the biggest part of the job is CRM.
So CRM is crew resource management, for those of you who haven't heard that phrase before, or that acronym. Yeah, crew resource management is referring to talking to ability to utilize all the people in your crew, and not just your crew, but outside the airplane, air traffic control and so on, to sort of get the best, safest conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Something along those lines. That's probably not
absolutely
summary,
no, it is. And it's, I guess you can summarize it as people skills. And I think that surprised me as to how much of an influence that has on the successful outcome of a day.
We mentioned earlier, didn't we, how that is just such a huge part of what we actually do. Totally. And what training in aviation is all about now.
Totally. And I didn't appreciate that going in. And I think actually maybe that came from the whole flight sim side, where flight sim is about flying the airplane. Because there's no multi-crew, there's no crew resource management, there's none of that. So it's all about, can I fly this airplane? Can I do this approach? am I going to get a smooth touchdown? You know, that is the bread and butter of our job, in terms of, can I fly the aircraft safely?
Yeah.
But that's kind of assumed. That's like the bit where it's like, the assumption is you're a qualified pilot, so you should be doing this, you know, in a safe manner. But the bit on top of that, where you can really push and become, I find, not only a better pilot, but a better person, is learning how to get the most out of the people around you. And you can apply CRM in your day-to-day life as well. It doesn't have to be on an aeroplane.
Yep.
And having empathy, understanding of other people's positions and that sort of stuff. So,
fantastic. That's
what surprised me the most, in terms of, especially as developed me as a person.
Excellent. Definitely. That's great. Great answer to that. Any tips for someone starting out in flight simulation? A top tip?
I think if you're starting out in flight simulation, I think it kind of comes back to us saying having an appreciation for what it is as a device, and enjoying it for what it is, and try not to, especially because I know there are some pretty hardcore simmers out there who want to do everything as realistic as possible, and I think that's fun in itself, but just make sure you're enjoying it and not allowing yourself to get wound up when things aren't perfectly aligned with the real world. Because I think we've discussed at length here how, because it's a desktop sim, there are limitations. And so I think that the key thing is, like, just enjoy it for what it is and have the best fun.
Sounds like great advice to me.
Just try not to put too much pressure on it, really.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. And then tips for anyone starting out in real world aviation, then a lot of our viewers or listeners obviously are thinking about it or would like to have a go at some sort of real world flying at some point.
I think go get that first lesson if you haven't already.
Yeah.
Whether it's just a trial, most flying clubs and flight schools and stuff do these little trial sessions.
Yeah.
If you're really young, probably say go join the air cadets, because they'll do that for free.
Absolutely.
But you know, if you're a little bit older and you want to just get into flying, then just go get that first lesson. They're not overly expensive. In fact, I gave one away on one of my streams.
Oh, did you? That's great. That's a good idea.
We did I just said, right, we're gonna do a giveaway for a real world trial lesson. And
fantastic.
And that filled me with a lot of excitement, and the chap who won went and did his flight and sent me photos of the day and had a great time and stuff. So
brilliant.
You know, they're not the most, that, you know, it depends on your financial position, but in terms of just getting yourself to have a go, whether it's half an hour or an hour just up in an aircraft, I think that is probably the best place to start. And certainly
totally
then you'll
agree.
Discover if you have the bug or not, you know.
Yeah, the risk there is that, or you might love it more than you thought, and then you're going to think about your career change or something, and that's the
it does come with a health warning that once you do it, you might not be able to go back.
Excellent. And then finally, my cat, my first officer, constantly interrupts my streams. Mm. So do you have the same issue?
I do. I have, I have two. For those who don't know, I've got Sandor and Luna. And I have a dual PC setup, and I now have to have guarded switches on my power buttons, because both my power buttons on both my computers are on top of the box, on top of the tower.
Yeah.
And because it's kind of a warm environment, cats tend to, like,
they just appear there.
So not only am I constantly cleaning hair out of my computer, which I imagine quite a few simmers listening to this going, oh my God, you let them sit on your computer. But it's like, I can't really do much about it because they are so adamant. So, but I remember streaming once, and Sandor stood on the power button of my gaming computer.
Right.
So the stream was still live. I was still live doing the camera, the microphone, everything, but the game itself just froze as far as they were concerned, and everyone's going, oh no, sim crash, and I was like, no, that crashed. The crash has turned off my computer. So but yeah, they definitely love to make an appearance from time to time.
Yeah, luckily my first officer, she has never turned off the computer, because it's up on the desk now, and she hasn't worked out that it's warm, so she doesn't go up there, so she just sits on my lap.
Don't tell her, because she discovers, that'll be it.
she has a habit of appearing usually on a crosswind landing or something like that, and we're streaming. She appears on the legs then, just when I can't just stop me moving them when I need them. But the 2 hours before that, she was nowhere to be seen when I was sitting there quite comfortably.
it's as if they know, isn't it?
They
go,
they do.
Are we on approach? Great.
Start scratching at the door. Excellent.
That's the one.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come along. It's been fantastic to chat to you today, Katie. Really, really appreciate it. And
yeah,
I'm
it's
sure
a
the
pleasure
listeners
to be
do as
here.
well.
Yeah.
Oh.
And like, honestly, thank you for inviting me on. I mean, it's been a long time coming that we collaborated. I know that a lot of my community in particular said, can you do something with 327 Pilot?
Yeah,
I'm like,
I had the same as well. Yeah.
yes.
I'm glad we've managed to
So
make it happen.
yeah, me too. I'm really glad to get together and have a chat. It's been really nice.
Fantastic. No, it's I've really enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll get you back on again in the future as we go through. Often I
Of
answer sort of
course.
questions from the community, so it'd be great to have your insight on those as well,
Yeah,
as we go
definitely. And
through.
I think, you know, if anyone does have any questions in the meantime, like either feel free to contact well, either of us directly, I suppose, or certainly pop them in the comments
Yeah.
and we'll kind of endeavor to answer them really.
And if people would like to, so you do still stream, so you're on Twitch at Katie Pilot on
Yeah,
Twitch.
so twitch.tv/KatiePilot.
Yeah.
And then kind of all my socials kind of go around Katie Pilot. So whether it's Twitter, Instagram, Discord as well.
Fantastic.
But yeah, so you know, come find me and you're more than welcome to ask any questions you may have, certainly about getting into flying and stuff. My aim in this whole, since I've picked up the streaming stuff, was to inspire. So I have quite a few people sometimes contact me and go, oh, I'm really sorry to bother you. And I'm like, you're not bothering me. I love answering questions and inspiring and stuff. So come at
Brilliant.
me with your questions and I will endeavor to give you the best answer I can.
Oh, that's great. No, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Katie. And we'll speak to you again in the future, I'm sure. Maybe we'll see what else we can collaborate on. But that's fantastic. And yeah, have a very good rest of your day.
Awesome. Thank you. You too. Thanks again.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Bye.
So that's all for today's podcast and this edition of From Flight Level 320. I hope you've enjoyed it. It was really fascinating for me to talk to another airline pilot with Katie and find out also some different ideas and perspectives from another Twitch streamer and content creator, as it were, as well as getting an insight into further into flight sim development. There'll be plenty more podcasts coming. As I said, do please send your questions to simpilot320@hotmail.com or join the 320 SimPilot Discord. There'll be another episode coming soon, as well as the live streams coming on the channel. Please keep spreading the word about the podcast. It makes all the difference. And I look forward to speaking, hearing, and discussing things and all things flight sim with you in future episodes. Thank you. Bye-bye.